I'm pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Professor Barry Eichengreen. Professor Eichengreen is an economist who holds the title of George C. Pardee and Helen N. Pardee, Professor of Economics and Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley, where he has taught since 1987. The professor has his best-known book is Golden Fetters, The Gold Standard in the Great Depression, 1919 to 1939. And his most recent book is Hall of Mirrors, The Great Depression, The Great Recession, and the Uses and Misuses of History. So, Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Professor, let me just jump right in. And in your book, Hall of Mirrors, you draw some parallels between the financial crises that we now know historically as the Great Depression and the most recent financial crises, which really occurred in 2008. Could you just, for the listeners, maybe explain some of those parallels?
There were striking parallels before the fact, before the crisis and the crash, a housing boom and bubble in the 1920s in Florida and to a lesser extent in the Midwest in cities like Chicago and Detroit, overly loose monetary policy by a newly created central bank, the Federal Reserve, and all kinds of excesses in financial markets. So I think you put those three things together and you have the elements of a crisis and a crash, which is what we had in 1929, and again in 2007-2008. The policy response in the two cases was quite different. Milton Friedman, the University of Chicago economist, famously accused the Fed of compounding the crash and causing the depression once it began. Ben Bernanke in 2002 at Milton Friedman's 90th birthday party famously said, "You're right, Milton, we," meaning the Fed, "did it," meaning the Great Depression, "and we won't do it again." So the Fed did respond more aggressively. I think historians will conclude much better this time around. Quantitative easing and zero interest rates were controversial, but we avoided another Great Depression due to the policy response, in my view.
So, Professor, given that according to some of the research and data that I've read, given that the too big to fail banks are now bigger than they were prior to the financial crisis, and given that the derivative exposure is higher, arguably, and for our listeners that may not be familiar, derivatives are essentially side bets that banks make based on certain things happening, like maybe interest rates movement. Are we setting ourselves up for a repeat of 2007 and 2008, in your opinion? And why or why, and if so, why? And if not, why not?
I think we are vulnerable to another crisis, not a repeat of 2007-2008, but something slightly different. Every crisis is different from its predecessors. I think we have failed to do enough to strengthen the banking and financial systems. So exactly as you said, the problem of banks that are too big to fail is still there. We haven't done enough to force feed additional capital to the banks. We haven't done enough to downsize big banks. We have failed to force derivative securities onto exchanges where they can be more safely treated. We failed to reform credit rating agencies, which I think were part of the problem before the crisis. And the irony is that our success at preventing another Great Depression led to this failure to do more to reform the financial system. In the 1930s, the prevailing financial system was totally discredited by its collapse. This time we prevented the system from collapsing, if barely, and that allowed the banks to regroup, the defenders of the current system to continue to argue in its defense. So the irony is that success was the mother of failure, heading off another financial crisis prevented us from doing more to strengthen the system. That's the argument at the core of my book, Hall of Mirrors.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're chatting today with Professor Barry Eichengreen, who is the author of Hall of Mirrors. And, Professor, we've got about 3 minutes left in this segment. I've had guests on the program who say that quantitative easing and the policy response to the financial crisis simply kicked the eventual problem down the road, that we're going to have to deal with this down the road, and that eventually the next crash or crisis will be worse than the one in 2007 and 2008. What would you say, or what would your response be or comment on that analysis?
My response would be that task number one, starting in 2008-2009, was to stabilize the patients, staunch the bleeding, prevent another depression, stabilize the economy, get growth going again. And then down the road, it becomes necessary and important to strengthen the system and prevent the same from happening again. I worry, as I said before, that we haven't done enough to strengthen the system. But I think letting the economy collapse, allowing unemployment to rise not only to 10%, as actually happened, but inaction would have allowed it to rise to 20% or 25%, as it did in 1933. That would have been too high a price to pay for teaching the banks and teaching the markets a lesson they wouldn't forget.
Well, Professor, moving ahead, and we've got about a minute and a half left, so we can pick it up in the next segment as well. Moving ahead, what should the Fed's policy be?
The Fed, I think, needs to focus on hitting its inflation target of 2%, and that's what it's doing at the moment, and use other tools, not monetary policy, but other tools to regulate the banks, prevent them from using too much leverage, not allow them to hold too little capital. The mistake that was made in 1929 was that the Fed raised interest rates because it was concerned about frothy financial markets. The Fed needs to keep its eye on price stability and economic stability when it sets interest rates and use other instruments, what the technicians call macroprudential tools, regulation, in other words, to deal with financial excesses. And I'm a little bit encouraged that that seems to be the approach the Fed now is taking.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there in this segment. Our guest today is Professor Barry Eichengreen, author of The Hall of Mirrors. I'll be continuing my conversation with Mr. Barry Eichengreen on the second podcast this week. You know, this past week, if you've been looking at the headlines at all, you saw that deflation is making headlines. In fact, just one example, there was an article published by Bloomberg this past week titled ECB, referring to the European Central Bank, ECB seeks to inject up to 1.1 trillion euros into economy in deflation fight. Well, what does all this mean, and why is it important to you? Well, on today's program, I want to talk about inflation and deflation in very simple terms, explain to you how it works, and more importantly, help you understand how you may be affected moving ahead. Now, many, including financial professionals from my experience, don't understand deflation. So I'm going to give you just a bit from my book, New Retirement Rules, that talks about deflation. And I'm going to give you an example that I think will be helpful in understanding this really important economic concept. Now, if I were to ask the average person to define inflation, I would most often get the answer, too much money chasing too few goods and services. Too much money chasing too few goods and services makes prices go up. And when we think about inflation, we think about rising prices. But that definition, the one I just gave you, is really a poor definition. Properly defined, inflation and deflation simply describe the level of money in circulation. Inflation is an expansion of the money supply, and our banking system is biased toward money creation and expansion. In fact, as Mr. Eichengreen pointed out, The Federal Reserve, the United States Central Bank, is trying to achieve 2% inflation, and as he noted, they haven't been doing it. Now, deflation is inflation's polar opposite. Deflation is a contraction of the money supply. Think about deflation as money's disappearing act. Now, a lot of folks believe that today's massive money printing by the Federal Reserve will lead to inflation and higher prices, which are symptoms of inflation. But history tells us today's economic conditions at today's level of money printing are far more likely to lead to deflation. Now, the Federal Reserve went on a money printing binge, and now the taper has kicked in. But in spite of this money printing binge, as I just mentioned, history suggests that a massive contraction of the money supply is likely. Now, why is that? Well, the explanation is really quite simple. You have to start with the fact that most of today's money is debt, not actual currency. Now, the idea that today's money is debt is a foreign concept to many, including many financial professionals. But let me give you an example to try to make the point clear. Say you have $50,000 cash in a bank account. You could go to your bank, withdraw the $50,000 in cash, bring the cash home, and stuff it under your mattress. That would give you $50,000 in actual currency under your mattress. Now let's say a relative of yours comes to you and asks to borrow $50,000. While you're open to helping out the relative, you'd like some collateral in order to protect yourself. So your relative offers to give you the title to her car and will allow you to place your name on the title as a lien holder. With this offer of collateral, you decide to take the $50,000 from under your mattress and loan the money to your relative at an interest rate of 5%. After all, the money was earning a 0% interest rate under the mattress, so you're happy with the 5% return, plus you have some collateral to help protect yourself. As long as your relative is creditworthy, and that's an important point, as long as your relative is creditworthy, you still have a $50,000 asset. The asset is just no longer cash. It's debt that's owed to you, but it's still an asset. If you were to put together a personal balance statement, you'd list the $50,000 loan payable to you as an asset. If you hadn't made the loan to your relative and still had the cash under the mattress, you'd list the cash as an asset of the same value on your personal balance statement. So the point is, whether the $50,000 is actual currency or a $50,000 loan that you've made, it's still $50,000 of money. When you give your paper currency asset to your relative, you're converting a cash asset to a debt asset. Cash and debt are both money. That's the point. Debt, or credit extended, is spent exactly the same way as actual currency. If you go buy a house and get a mortgage, you're taking on debt, but that debt got you a house. It spends exactly like currency. That brings me back to my original point. Most money today is debt. Debt owed by one person or entity to another person or entity is an asset to the person to whom the debt is owed. And in our financial system, most money is the liability of another person or another entity. This money remains an asset as long as the borrower is creditworthy. However, should the borrower not pay up, the asset's value may be reduced and the money disappears from the system. Technically defined, this is deflation. Deflation is simply money disappearing from the financial system. So let's go back to your relative. Let's say your relative comes to you after you've given her the loan of $50,000 and tells you she can no longer make payments on the loan. She's lost her job, and in spite of her best efforts, there's no way she'll ever be able to pay you back. She voluntarily brings you the car you took as collateral on the loan so you can attempt to recover your asset. After a few weeks, you realize the car might bring $20,000, which is nowhere close to the $50,000 you're owed on the loan. You simply decide to cut your losses and sell the car. You pocket the $20,000 and write off the $30,000 loss to bad judgment. That is $30,000 that's just disappeared from your personal balance statement. And that $30,000 has just disappeared from the financial system. When most money is debt and debt levels are too high to possibly be paid, money will disappear from the financial system and the money supply will contract. This is deflation. So the Federal Reserve and now the European Central Bank's going to also attempt to do this. And the bank, the Central Bank of Japan and many of the other central banks around the world have been attempting to add money to the system faster than money disappears through the system through defaults on debt. Trouble is, they're fighting an uphill battle. Given the level of debt that exists today worldwide, simple math tells you there's more debt that can ever possibly be paid. There's a simple economic rule that has proven itself to be true for more than 2,000 years. If there's more debt that can be paid, not all the debt will be paid. If there's more debt than can be paid, not all the debt will be paid. And that's exactly where we are today. There's far more debt that can ever possibly be paid. Since most money is debt, this means money will have to disappear from the system as defaults occur on the debt. Money will do a disappearing act and deflation will be the result. That's where we are right now. Central banks have been staving off deflation but not hitting their inflation targets, and we'll talk more about this in the last segment of today's program. And now deflation is beginning to set in and policymakers are concerned. What will deflation mean to you? Well, I'll talk about it more in the last segment, but the first thing I'd point out is that historically speaking, stocks don't like deflation. Stocks don't do well. With interest rates this low and the next move in interest rates being up as credit risks actually get higher as it gets more risky to loan not only individuals but corporations and government's money, interest rates will spike. That can be really bad news if you have a 401k plan or IRA with stocks and bonds. I'd like to offer you a free resource. We call it our Investor's Discovery Kit. If you've not already received our Investor's Discovery Kit, it contains the book, New Retirement Rules, which was my book that was released just a few months ago. Very, very relevant as to what's going on now in the economy. You'll also get a copy of the New Economy magazine, as well as an educational CD and DVD. The Discovery Kit is free. If you've not yet received it, just go to investingapproach.com and request it. Let us know where you'd like us to mail the kit, and we'd be glad to do that. Again, the website is investingapproach.com. That's our first podcast for the week. Hope you'll tune in again the second podcast when I continue my conversation with Mr. Barry Eichengreen. Bye.